Well, happy Mother's Day. Who are the mothers again? Let me see hands. I didn't get to see them. Oh, right. Yes, hands for everybody. Well, happy Mother's Day. And I wanted to talk about mothers this morning. How about that? But probably in a way that you haven't discussed them before. So we're going to take a little journey and see where we end up and see how this all goes. But what I wanted to do to begin with is something that I've done for the last couple of years, but I never get tired of it. Some of you have heard it before, but if you haven't, it's really instructive about the nature of our relationships, because the nature of the relationships interpersonally with all of us is really coded into the Hebrew language. And it's fascinating the way this works. Semitic languages are very different than English and very different than Western languages in the sense that they are what is called a root and pattern system. And so each letter of the 22 letters of the alphabet has a name and has a meaning. It also has a number, and the number has a meaning. And so words have, you know, both a gematria, which is a numerical value, which has a meaning. But the name itself, when you add up those letters, has a combination of the meanings of those letters. And so Hebrew words are very descriptive. And it's almost like you can go back in time, because a letter has a meaning, right? You put a second letter with it and it's called a parent root. You put a third letter with it, it's called a child root. And when you add letters beyond that, you actually have words. Well, the language started simple and it became more complex as it went. So as you go back to the roots, you're actually going back in time to the meaning that originally was placed on these concepts and then coded with these letters and these words. And so when we look at the names for father and mother and brother and son or daughter or children, the basic building blocks of our family, we find in those two-letter roots the meaning of the relationship and the meaning of the role that each person plays. And even the name of God does the same thing. So God, the name of God is El. You've probably heard that before. And it's Aleph Lamed. And Aleph is the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet, and it's the analog of our letter A. So if you think of a letter A, originally the Aleph was a picture of an ox's head, and the pictograms that preceded the alphabet were actually very stylized drawings of what they exactly were supposed to be. At some point they got rotated, and we don't know why, just the manuscript evidence, at some point the letters rotated. So the ox's head with a triangular face and the horns rotated, isn't that fascinating, to become our letter A. But what it meant was the ox to the Hebrews was the strongest domestic animal, the largest and the strongest. And so Aleph meant strong. Lamed was the picture of the shepherd's staff, the crooked staff, which, you know, rotated, becomes our letter L. But that meant to lead, to guide. And so a strong leader is exactly what L means, or Al. Strong leader. That's how they saw their God, as a strong leader. The word for father, Ab, Aleph Bet, the two first letters. Aleph, we already know, is strong. Bet was a picture of the floor plan of a Hebrew tent when they were still nomads, with the wall down the middle and the two halves for the male and female parts of their families. And so you see that still in our letter B, the two halves of the tent. But the tent, or the house, the father was the strong house. The father was the one who gave rigidity, who gave shape to the family, who created the umbrella under which the family could live and exist. He was the pole that kept everything in place. Now, mother, M, E or A can be denoted in Aleph. And so it's still Aleph, strong, is the first letter of M. The next one, Mem, is ripples of water, still reflected in our letter M, isn't it? And so mother, M, or Ima, as the children would say, mommy, literally meant strong water. Now, what does that mean? What the heck is strong water? Well, when they used to tan their hides, they would boil them first. And what would rise to the surface of that boiling water was a sticky substance that came out of the glutens and the fats of the hide. And they literally used it as glue. They used it as adhesive in their daily use. And so the mother, the strong water, was seen as the glue that held the family together. Isn't that amazing? Brother, Hetz. The Aleph and the Hetz is the picture of a wall. A brother was seen as a strong wall. To have as many children as possible was to be prosperous in this early nomadic system. To have many brothers who acted literally as the army of the clan. They were the wall. They were the protective core that protected the family from the outside. And then the son or the daughter, Ben. You still have Bet, the house. And you have Nun, which is a picture of a germinating seed, the head of the seed with the tail. And so literally Ben was the house that continues. And Banaya, Ben plus A-Y-A, which in Hebrew signifies, without limit, stretching without limit, were the generations, the continuation. And so all of these words coded into the language give us the meaning of the relationships and the meaning of what each person was supposed to do. In that society, everyone had a place. Everybody knew who they were and how they were supposed to function. It's one of the tragedies of our society today that we don't know that anymore. Everybody's confused. What does it mean to be a man? What does it mean to be a woman? All the roles are changing since the 60s, right? You know, we got metrosexuals. We got all these people trying to figure out what their roles are these days. Not so. In ancient Hebrew, everybody knew. It was coded right into the words for the roles and the members of the family. And so what we see is mother and father, the strong house, strong water. The umbrella, the shape to the family under which the family can gather and be safe, but the glue that holds it all together. Both of these are necessary. They're complementary. You know, we can always ask, and we sometimes do, which is more important? You know, it's a very Western thing to want to know. Is it more important to have the strong house? Is it more important to have the glue that holds the family together? Within our own personalities, we oscillate between the two. Going out and trying to provide for the family, but coming home and trying to have a family, trying to have the relationships that make any of this work that we do make any sort of sense at all. And so we oscillate back and forth. We see male and female roles being played out, you know, largely in these areas. Women much more attuned to relationship, much more tuned to family. Fathers much more tuned to going out and conquering and doing what they do. Not that this happens all the time, but it is something that is coded into our DNA and coded into the Hebrew language. And so we see the strong house and we see the strong water. We see the difference between accomplishment and relationship, between doing and being, between Martha and Mary, right? Martha, the one that was running around trying to take care of the house, take care of the meal for Jesus, and Mary, the one who just wanted to sit at his feet. And Martha complaining about Mary and then Jesus upbraiding her. It wasn't that one was more important than the other. It's that both are necessary. Both are complementary. Both need to exist. And this is a hallmark of Hebrew thinking. We in the West want to separate things, divide them up, put them in categories, have them be diametrically opposed, like good and evil, you know, opposite ends of the spectrum, diametrically opposed, at war with one another, cosmic battles, you know, all that sort of thing. To the Hebrews, it was one thing. To the Hebrews, everything was a unity. Everything was looking at something maybe from one side or the other, a continuum, if you will. Literally, good and evil in Hebrew mean ripe and unripe, mature, immature, functional, or dysfunctional. And everybody is someplace on that road from unripeness to ripeness. But it's one thing. It's just who we are at any given moment that makes the difference. Light and dark, we see those as opposites. It's interesting in Genesis 1, when the Father says, "Let there be light," and preceding that, darkness hovers over the face of the deep. Those words for darkness and light, nura, light, hoshek, darkness, don't necessarily mean light and dark that we can see with our eyes. What they really mean and what they really refer to is chaos and order. I've heard some people say, how could there be light before God created the sun and the moon? Because he creates that later, right? And that seems like a big conundrum, and something's wrong with the text here. What God is doing is creating order out of chaos. The darkness is the curved energies, the swirling energies of wind and water. The light is a straight rays of the sun, of clarity, of understanding. But both are necessary, just like day and night. Yom, day, Layla, night. The understanding is that the daytime is when you go out and you do clear things. You work. You understand with the clarity of daylight. Night is a time for repose and for assimilation, to move into the dream state, to get rested, to be refreshed for the next day's activities. But it's a cycle. It's circular. It oscillates back and forth. One is not better than the other. They are not at war with one another. They are working together as a unit, as one thing. And father and mother are like this. They are day and night, literally. The male, the straight line, curved, linear thinking. The feminine, the more intuitive, curved. Can't quite tell how it gets where it gets, but it gets there. And it gets there faster than the straight line thinking does, with all the steps that need to be taken in the meantime. Both are necessary. Both are to be revered. And indeed, in Hebrew culture, mother and father were absolutely revered. Now, what about God? What does it say about our Father? First of all, we call him our Father, right? So he's a male God. But something in us tells us that we know that God is not a man, right? But there's something about him that we call him Father. But just as easily, we could call him Mother. God is not man or woman, male or female, certainly. God is spirit, but God encompasses both masculine and feminine. First time I said this in the last church, I got in a lot of trouble. Mother God, are you kidding me? It just sounds so wrenching to our culture and to our ears, doesn't it? But somewhere back, we know that God must encompass the feminine as well. And in the Hebrew culture, they had a divine feminine. Now, don't go there. Don't say that, oh, I'm talking about some sort of feminine goddess that the Hebrews worshipped. Of course not. God is one. The actual Shema, the holiest prayer of Hebrew, of the Israelites, you know, was Shema Yisrael, listen, hear, O Israel. Adonai, Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. The Lord our God, the Lord is one. That oneness was absolute. But they understood that the Father God had an application, had a manifestation, had a realization of his will on earth. And that was understood as Chokhmah, which means wisdom. And wisdom was always feminine, was always female. Those of you who have read Proverbs, Proverbs 1:20, I don't know if Greg could get it up on the... I'm surprising him here. But Proverbs 1:20-21, wisdom shouts in the streets. She lifts her voice in the square. At the head of the noisy street, she cries out. At the entrance of the gates of the city, she utters her sayings. And so on and so forth. Through the entire book of Proverbs, wisdom is personified as a woman. It was understood that wisdom was this other part of God that was not straight and forward. It's something that had to be experienced differently. You know, not that he's male, but that there's something in the realization of God's kingdom here on earth that caused her to be seen as feminine, to be seen as mother. You know, even we in English would say that wisdom is the application of knowledge. Have you heard that one before? Wisdom and knowledge are different somehow. Knowledge is one thing, wisdom is something else. So wisdom is sort of the application of knowledge. Think about it this way. Knowledge is when you have a lot of things to say. Wisdom is knowing when to keep your mouth shut. How about that? Wisdom applies knowledge to life. It makes us able to live life well. All the knowledge in the world will probably make you absolutely miserable. Because what do you do with it unless you can apply it? We want to go to our books and we want to study and we want to understand God. If I could just understand him right, then I can get this whole thing under my fingertips. I know where I'll be going after I die. I've got it together. Straight line thinking. Father, Nura, light, clarity. But what happens when you go out into the streets of your life with all that knowledge, armed with all of that stuff, you know, your MAs and your BAs and all these things that you know, and then life comes along and mugs you and you don't know a thing anymore? How do you apply that? How do you even learn what it means to be a successful liver of life? Because it doesn't come out of a book. We know that one too. Knowledge without wisdom means that there's no effect in our life. There's no transformation. There's nothing that changes because we know stuff. Our lives change when we start to live stuff. But how can God be both father and mother at the same time? How does this work? Well, let me ask you a question. Can the earth be both round and flat at the same time? I saw one head go up and down. Riddle me this. Can the world be round and flat at the same time? Absolutely it can. We know that the earth is round. It's round in fact. But it's flat in experience, isn't it? Do we ever experience a round earth as we walk about on it? It appears flat. Everything in our experience says it's flat. Everything that we do demands a flat surface that we can perform whatever it is that we're performing on. We experience it as flat, even though it's round. God is a strong house. He's a strong house in fact. He has created this universe. He has created everything that we need to live and to thrive. But we experience him as strong water. We experience him as the glue that holds everything together. We experience him in the deepness of that relationship. We know he's a strong house. We can see that. But until we experience him as mother, as the relationship that never ends or can be altered, we can't live our lives successfully. We can't live our lives without fear. We can't go where we need to go. What good is a strong house without the glue to hold it together? What good is it going out and gaining the whole world if you come back and your house is a shambles and there's nothing to come home to? No meaning, no purpose for everything that you do. You know, we have a 6-year-old boy. His name is Brennan. And Brennan is a mama's boy. I have no problem saying that. And he can listen to this recording in 10 years and probably cringe. But he is, and he's exactly where he should be. You know, he's completely fixated on mom, follows her everywhere he goes. In fact, most of the time, 9 times out of 10, when he comes to me, is to say, "Hey, Dad, where's mom?" Well, what am I, chop liver? But it's a different type of relationship. Brennan, at this age, is steeped in not doing, but being. Not in accomplishment, but in relationship. Time really doesn't have any meaning for him. He is connected to his mother, and she connects to him naturally. It's exactly what's supposed to happen. Maybe my time will come later, when he moves off into the day. You know, it's exactly as it should be. All of us begin our lives in Hoshech, in darkness, in chaos, in intuition, in the curved spaces. As we grow, as we hit the age of reason, we move into the light. We move into Nura. We move into straight line thinking and clarity. And we crave it. And we think it gives us power, gives us some sort of control over our lives and our circumstances. And so we glom onto it. We hang onto it. We cling to it. We try to cultivate it. You know, we want clarity. God, give me clarity. Please, Lord, show me what to do. Show me your will. All of those are cries for Nura, for enlightenment, right? We want to know with our minds because we think it'll make our lives better. And all of that searching for Nura, we add all this knowledge. But without Hoshek, without the feminine, without the curved spaces, it doesn't mean a thing. We grow from a child in the curved space of darkness into the straight lines and logical clarity of light. But what does Jesus tell us? You need to go back to being a child before you can enter the kingdom, doesn't he? There is something about mother. There is something about wisdom that is connected to the child, that is connected to the way the child experiences life. And we've got to get that, because we keep running in the absolute wrong direction. It's not that we leave all our knowledge behind. We bring it with us into the curved spaces. We assimilate it into ourselves in a deep way that we can't even really express. We have to be able to do this. We must be able to go back. Now, when you think about Jesus' life with his mother, unfortunately, well, I shouldn't say that. I suppose there is just the right amount in Holy Scripture of stories about Jesus with his mother, but there are just so few of them. And most of them are here right now in your bulletin. I want to read a couple of them because it's instructive to see, how did Jesus live his life? Did it have the same shape, the same trajectory? If he's our model, if he's the way shower for us of how to move toward the Father, if he literally is the way, then what is he showing us? At Luke 2, 41 to 51, famous story. Jesus is 12 years old. Now his parents went to Jerusalem every year at the feast of Passover. And when he became 12, they went up there according to the custom of the feast. And they were returning after spending the full number of days. The boy Jesus stayed behind in Jerusalem, but his parents were unaware of it, supposed him to be in the caravan, and went a day's journey. And they began looking for him among their relatives and acquaintances. And when they did not find him, they returned to Jerusalem looking for him. Then after 3 days, they found him in the temple, sitting in the midst of the teachers, both listening to them and asking them questions. And all who heard him were amazed at his understanding and his answers. When they saw him, they were astonished. And his mother said to him, "Son, why have you treated us this way?" It's all about her, right? "Why have you treated us this way? Behold, your father and I have been anxiously looking for you." And he said to them, "Why is it that you are looking for me? Did you not know that I had to be in my father's house?" But they did not understand the statement which he had made to them. And he went down with them and came to Nazareth, and he continued in subjection to them. And his mother treasured all these things in her heart. And I probably should have included the last verse, which says that Jesus kept increasing in wisdom and stature and in favor to God and among men. Jesus was learning. He was growing in wisdom, growing in stature. But here's the important thing for our purposes this morning. Jesus started like any other child, right? In Hoshek. He had to be held. He had to be fed. He had to be cleaned. He had to be taught. Taught to speak, taught to walk, all the things that children do. And he was a mama's boy. He clung to his mother as his father went off and did what he did during the day. But at age 12, he started to make a shift into the light, to talk to the elders about the things of God and the things of life, to ask questions, to answer questions. But he realized that he needed to stay in subjection to his parents at this point, and he moves back into subjection, but he doesn't leave the light. He integrates the light into the darkness, the wisdom into the knowledge. And then at John 2, 1-5, on the third day there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. And both Jesus and his disciples were invited to the wedding. Okay, Jesus already has disciples at this point. How many years have elapsed? Well, we don't know. Could be as many as 18. He was about 30 when he started his public ministry. This is just before he gets going in earnest with his public ministry. So we don't really know. But it was a far time. You know, it was years, something on that order. Both Jesus and his disciples are invited to the wedding. When the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what does that have to do with us? My hour has not yet come." A little bit rude, but he's trying to make a point here, isn't he? But look what his mother does. She's not insulted. She's not dismayed. She doesn't even take a breath or blink. She turns to the servants and she says, "Whatever he says to you, do it." She knows her son. She knows that he's in submission to her. She knows that he has compassion. It's hard for us to overestimate what it would mean to the bride and groom, or the father and mother of the groom, who is hosting this party, to run out of wine. That would be a faux pas that they would probably never live down for the rest of their lives in the village. To save them from that humiliation, to keep the party going. You know, in the scheme of things, how great is that? Doesn't really matter. These were the circumstances Jesus was presented with, and he responds, of course. He responds to his mother. We see the trajectory of his life moving between darkness and light, understood as wisdom and knowledge. By Matthew 12:46, while he was still speaking to the crowds, this is deep into his ministry, behold, his mother and brothers were standing outside, seeking to speak to him. Someone said to him, behold, your mother and brothers are standing outside, seeking to speak to you. But Jesus answered the one who was telling him and said, who is my mother? Who are my brothers? And stretching out his hand toward his disciples, he said, behold, my mother and my brothers. For whoever does the will of my Father who is in heaven, he is my brother and sister and mother. Here is Jesus making another shift. Beyond blood, beyond clan, beyond earthly relationships, and saying it's not just necessarily about blood, it's about choice. It's about what you choose that connects you to me and me to you, connects all of us to each other. I'm adopted, and so I have no idea who my blood relatives are. The only blood relatives I know about are my children, three of them. I'm connected to them by blood. Maybe because I've always known that I was adopted, it's been no big deal. Maybe because I've always been known I'm adopted and I don't know any of my relatives, haven't sought them out, they haven't sought me out. That blood doesn't mean a whole lot. To me, family is about choice. You know, my wife chose me, I chose her. That's family to me. Blood is nice. But choice is something that we do for ourselves and for each other. It's an amazing thing. Jesus is moving through the relationships. We see the trajectory of his life. And then finally at John 19:26, when Jesus then saw his mother, he's hanging on the cross now, and the disciple whom he loved standing nearby, he said to his mother, woman, behold your son. And then he said to the disciple, behold your mother. From that hour, the disciple took her into his own household. This is Jesus coming full circle. Back to childhood, back to connectedness with his mother, making sure that she was cared for as his relationship with her would be changing. But here's what we see. We see Jesus moving from the place of curved energies and darkness in the sense of chaos and intuitional, experiential thinking into the light and back again. That's the trajectory of his life. This is what he's trying to get across to us, trying to get us to understand that this is exactly what we have to do. If we can't move back into that way of experiencing life in the moment, we'll never be able to enter kingdom. The head games we play with ourselves, the knowledge that becomes paramount in our thinking blocks any way to be able to do that. So the question we should be asking ourselves by this time is, how in the world do I do that? How in the world do I get to a place where I'm starting to live on the dark side? Live these curved energies, these intuitional, especially for someone like me that is so linear thinking. You know, so intellectually based, so OCD. You know, how do I do that? How do I get to that place? Have children. That's a good answer right there. They'll cure you of a lot of things. But there's something deeper. And in the book, Our Father Abraham, Marvin Wilson hits on this beautifully when he talks about the way that the Hebrews allowed themselves to live in paradox, to live in contradiction, not to need to resolve everything with their heads, but to simply just play through like a golfer. You know, don't worry about all that stuff. Just play through. Stop trying to figure everything out. And I want to read a couple of paragraphs from his book. Listen, the Hebrew knew that he did not know all the answers. Duh, my kids would say. But don't we think that we should? Don't we spend so much of our time trying to figure everything out? Don't we pride on ourselves on having all the answers? Because this guy sure doesn't, you know. But we do. We've got the truth. The Hebrew knew he did not know all the answers. His position was under the sun. That's from Ecclesiastes. So his words were few. He refused to over-systematize or force harmonization on the enigmas of God's truth or the puzzles of the universe. He realized that no one could straighten what God has made crooked. All things, therefore, did not need to be fully rational. The Hebrew mind was willing to accept the truths taught on both sides of the paradox. It recognized that mystery and apparent contradictions are often signs of the divine. Stated succinctly, the Hebrews knew the wisdom of learning to trust in matters they could not fully understand. Put that one on your refrigerator. Hebrews knew the wisdom of learning to trust in matters they could not fully understand. We don't need to understand the things we trust. We just need to trust them. And we're only going to trust them when we experience their trustworthiness. How do you do that? Well, at some point, you got to risk something. You got to step out and see what happens. The Semites of Bible times did not simply think truth. They experienced truth. As we have previously emphasized, truth is as much an encounter as it is a proposition. This experiential perspective on reality explains in part why Judaism never really developed vast systems of thought. It also allows us to understand how Judaism could live with the tensions and paradoxes surrounding their block logic. To the Jew, the deed was always more important than the creed. I love that. The deed is always more important than the creed. He was not stymied by language that appeared contradictory from a human point of view. Neither did he feel compelled to reconcile what seemed irreconcilable. He believed that God ultimately was greater than any human attempt at systematizing truth, walking in the truth, 2 John 4, and living the truth, 1 John 1, were a higher priority than rationally analyzing the truth. In the words of the renowned biblical scholar Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, we Jews are practical. We are more interested in discovering what God wants man to do than in describing God's essence. As a teacher, I never try to solve questions because most questions are unsolvable. He concludes, Judaism is never afraid of contradictions. It acknowledges that full reconciliation of the two is possible only in God. He is the coincidence of opposites. I love that. The coincidence of opposites. This is our God. You want to know how to move back into the childhood that can take us to kingdom? Stop trying to think your way to God. Let it go. Stop trying to do your way to God. Let it go. That's father thinking, okay? That's not mother thinking. That's father thinking. And if you think about your fathers, the father always needed to be pleased, right? The father always had a standard that you had to meet. That's the way fathers are wired. Many of us spend the rest of our lives trying to please our dads because we couldn't do it as children. That's an exhausting way to live. And it doesn't transform us. It doesn't take us where we need to go. But what about mother? What about mom? You hear the expression, a face only a mother could love? Moms are pretty forgiving, aren't they? Moms love the child simply because they are hers, because they are there. There is no standard. That's why the two need to be one. Because where the mother might be too easy, the father might be too harsh, but the middle ground between the two is just right. Enough discipline, enough standard. Enough motivation to move forward, to excel. But always with the knowledge that acceptance exists just because. This is father and mother. This is Nura and Hoshech. This is the balance that Jesus is trying to get us to see. God is both father and mother. But we connect to him through mother. Now as I say this, I realize that some of you had good mothers. Some of you have wonderful memories of your mother. And for some of you, this is connecting. Some of us who had good mothers go through the rest of our lives trying to create that relationship, don't we? Men marry their mothers, women look for the kind of acceptance and connection that they had. But there's other of us that did not have good relationships with their mothers or had no relationships with their mothers. And they spend the rest of their lives trying to find that type of acceptance and that type of relationship. Whatever your experience is, however you're sitting there hearing these words and what they're doing to you as you listen to them, what we need to understand is that type of relationship is already present in our God, in our Father, in our Mother, God. It's already there. We already have it. When the elder brother complains to the father about the younger brother coming back and getting the party, the father turns to him and says, what? Everything I have is already yours. What part of everything don't you understand? How could you get more than everything? Why do you keep seeking? Why are you still looking when everything I have is already yours and has been before you were born? And diminishing your brother, diminishing anyone else is not going to increase your stake. You already have everything. The acceptance is there because you are sitting here breathing. This is the divine feminine. This is the part of God that we don't understand very well until we experience it. How? I had someone just asking this last Wednesday, how do we do this? And I was telling them, you know, the best way that I know of to experience what we're talking about here is to simply be mindful of the moment. Every moment that you're in, where are you? When you stop and you realize that the conversation you're having, you haven't heard for the last three paragraphs, you know, that you missed three exits on the freeway, that you have to reread the paragraph that you're reading three and four times because you keep going back inside your head and you're no longer present to the moment. Stop as soon as you become aware and make yourself present. Look into that person's eyes. See them, hear them, respond to them. Respond to your environment. You know, as one writer says, if you're washing the dishes, really wash the dishes. Feel the soap, feel the texture. Become present to the moment. In our presence with each other and with the moment, we start to get glimpses of the God who lives in the moment. And I know that sounds weak to the Western linear mind. I know that it sounds like nothing, and it sounds like a platitude on a greeting card. But until you experience it, you won't know how powerful it is, and you won't know where it can drive you and where it can take you along this journey that we're taking. Mindfulness. Accept the contradictions and paradoxes that you see. Stop trying to rationalize them and harmonize them. Stop letting the contradictions that you see in life take you out of life because you won't accept them, because you think there must be some other way. How many of us would voluntarily walk right past Jesus because we won't accept the inherent contradictions that he may provide to us? Have you ever thought about that? Maybe this judgment we are so worried about isn't so much God doing to us, but us simply walking past what God has to offer because we're expecting something else, because the contradictions are too great for us, because the wrong people are already there. It's a taking everything that we know and turning it around and looking at it from another point of view. Rest in the unknowing. Rest in the chaos. Celebrate the contradictions in life. They're beautiful. Without the contradictions, there's no interest. Everything that is perfectly symmetrical and harmonized is also perfectly boring. Ever think about that? Things need to be a little off-center. Things need to be a little bit wrong to be really right. I mean, that's just the way we're wired as human beings. It is the paradox. It is the contradiction that keeps us guessing, interested, and alive, looking for the next thing that God has for us. Make friends with that. Celebrate that. Enjoy that. Lavish yourself in abandonment to those things because they are all the pieces of life. I wanted to read a little bit of a poem by T.S. Eliot. And I think I'm just going to read it. We'll talk about it in a second. This is the very end of a poem that he wrote during the Blitz in London in 1941. And it was it's called The Four Quartets. This is the third of the four parts of the poem, and just a very few ending stanzas. And he writes, "For most of us, there is only the unattended moment, the moment in and out of time, the distraction fit, lost in a shaft of sunlight, the wild thyme unseen, or the winter lightning, or the waterfall, or music heard so deeply that it is not heard at all. But you are the music while the music lasts." These are only hints and guesses, hints followed by guesses, and the rest is prayer, observance, discipline, thought, and action. The hint half guessed, the gift half understood, is incarnation. Here the impossible union of spheres of existence is actual. Here the past and future are conquered and reconciled. Where action were otherwise movement of that which is only moved and has in it no source of movement, driven by demonic, thonic powers, and right action is freedom from past and future also. For most of us, this is the aim, never here to be realized, who are only undefeated because we have gone on trying. We, content to the last, if our temporal reversion nourish, not too far from the yew tree, the life of significant soil. Now, as you listen to that, you probably had two reactions. I know I did. And the first was that there is a profound beauty there, a profound significance in these words. And the second was, what the heck is he talking about? There is no one interpretation to something like this. There is no one way that you can look at it. It'll mean different things to different people if you take the time to really dive into it. The first way of looking at this is the mother speaking to our hearts. Choshek, chokmah, pure experience. It's just the stream of conscious experience of something in the poet's mind. The second is the father trying to understand and resolve those experiences. But as soon as we try to understand them, we step away from them and we're no longer part of them anymore. Let the contradiction lie. Let the paradox lie. Let the experience be what it is. Try not to think and overanalyze. We need both father and mother always, but we begin with mother, and we must return to her if we are going to return to kingdom, pure experience, become children, lose ourselves in music that is heard so deeply that it's not heard at all, and to finally understand that we are the music as long as the music lasts. Let's pray. Father, thank you for the baby who is cooing in the back. Pure experience. Ah, pure Hoshek. Allow us to be more like that, Lord. Like Melody who ran through here a moment. You know, unabashed, unembarrassed, just walks through, going to mom. Can we be more like that, Father? Can we be more unafraid, unabashed, unembarrassed, to simply experience life, to not worry so much, to be so self-conscious, to be so shamed, to see what comes and not try to order everything all the time? That's what we need. That's what we want, Father. Help us first to understand the concept so that we can simply leave the concept alone and just practice it in our moments. We want to be more like you, Lord. We want to experience moments for what they are and not what we think they should be. And in that way, know more and more about you, to become more and more unafraid, to know that we have a seat at your table and we are loved with a mother's love and a father's love. In Jesus' name. Amen.